economic research into innovation, and innovation policy is flourishing. But how can it be used to help Europe's economies? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. The European Community Frame Project, of which the CEPR is a partner, has been running since April 2017 and is coming to an end at a conference called Understanding the Interaction Between Macroeconomics and Innovation Policy. And as you can hear in the background, I'm here in London at the conference today for a special edition of Vox Talks. I'll be talking to some of the attendees about what the project has achieved and what they think about the future of innovation policy in Europe.
It's a great pleasure to welcome you.
Europe's expenditure on R&D was 2% of GDP in 2016. The European Union's Horizon 2020 goal is to raise this to 3%. Frame's researchers argue that if we have better macro models of how innovation policy affects the economy, then policy can do a better job of helping Europe's firms innovate successfully. In its two-year life, Frame has mushroomed to take in a much wider set of related topics, though, on subjects like measuring technology, labour markets and spillovers. And this means the conference has attracted a surprisingly broad range of papers, academics and policymakers. Now, Frame exists because of a grant from Horizon 2020, and one of the people who helped make that grant possible is Roman Arjona, the chief economist at the Commission's Directorate General for Research and Innovation. I asked him how the project got started.
It started because we were in the European Commission thinking that indeed, you know, research and innovation is known by everybody as a source of growth and source of well-being in society. This is undeniable and fully justified by a big body of evidence. But instead, when we look at macroeconomic models that are used by ministries of finance, of economics, central banks, these are actually very, very patchy in capturing research and innovation. If you look around, for instance, at the case of the Netherlands, you see that they are actually doing proper modeling of their electoral program. So they take the electoral program of each of the parties, they run a model on them, and then they feed this to the press, and it has a wide audience. Everybody's conscious about what are the welfare implications of all these electoral programs. And what about if science is not playing its role there? Are we getting the picture right? Are we doing the allocation of resources right? Are we really putting the efforts where we think that they should be? And this is what was the rationale for setting up Frame.
Roman, how big a risk is it if we get innovation policy wrong in Europe?
Oh, well, that's actually a pretty big risk. There is currently a rise of the digital world. So we see artificial intelligence, we see machine learning algorithms, we see robotics, we see genomics appearing in the market. And this is leading to a deep transformation of our society, of our economy. Transition towards this digital economy will be very important, because otherwise you risk leaving quite a few segments of the population behind. So we think that this is basically traceable back to two factors. The first one is that innovation is becoming very complex nowadays. So there is not any longer an off-the-shelf solution for an innovation that has to be put in the market. And innovation are also becoming deep tech, so they are very much connected to science. You can see examples, for instance, such as in the field of automated vehicles, where you have a convergence of ICT, energy, transport, science, technological developments.
But if I'm running a business in Europe and I see this research being published on an open platform, I'd say, if you've got something that gives me a competitive advantage, why are you telling the world about it? Why are we sharing all the output of Frame?
That's actually a very good point. You know that we are fostering the European Union and inside already Horizon 2020, which is the current European program that is funding research and innovation. Even more in the Horizon Europe program, we are fostering an approach of open data and open access to the research results, because we consider that indeed, you know, I mean, if we are looking, for example, in this type of models, we're looking at problems that are linked to knowledge diffusion. We should actually be the ones, you know, that should be spearheading that kind of movement and making it sure, you know, that everything that comes out of these projects is actually usable by the scientific community to advance the frontier of knowledge and to give us even more solutions to the ones that Frame is putting on the table.
The Frame Research took its original brief and expanded the scope massively. So I asked Diego Comi of Dartmouth College, who's a CEPR fellow and, as the initiator of the Frame project, the person who did a lot of the extra work, why that happened.
What drove our efforts was not the commission or a contract ultimately, but our research interest. And so because we wanted to pursue good research, we just moved in the directions that we thought were most attractive from a research standpoint. We still kept the focus on the topics that the commission was interested in that sense there was no conflict of interest.
Diego and his co-author Francesco Bianchi from Duke University, he's also a CEPR researcher, both presented papers at this conference. So was it an advantage to have such a diverse audience?
We created a very large group and heterogeneous group of people working on a certain theme, but very much from different angles. So I don't think I would have had this level of interaction with these other researchers if I hadn't been part of Frame. I think that's definitely something I appreciate about the whole idea and what the commission has been doing from that point of view. The second aspect, I think that is quite different, but it's connected to the first one, is also having these deadlines, these events, that is a bit like going back to school in which you are given a deadline to complete a certain task, was also useful in, again, bringing together people that normally would not interact with each other, even if they're all working on innovation, but they do it in such different ways that normally they wouldn't be in the same room discussing innovation or discussing the impact of innovation or the impact of macro policies or micro policies on innovations.
What was also pleasantly surprising was to which extent all of the outsiders that came to the conference embrace some of the key themes that we have used in Frame. It was hard to tell apart who was from our team and who was not at the end.
No, I agree. I think the level of participation during the conference and also after the talks, people asking questions and trying to understand how you would translate a certain result in your model into a policy prescription, how you would go to explain it also to students. It was really rewarding. It means that we are working on things that even people outside the immediate circle of colleagues that you generally meet every day in all conferences around the world can find interesting, and they can relate to them, and they understand that it's something that can potentially have an impact on real life.
As the conference promised in its title, these 2 days weren't just about presenting research, it was also about investigating how that research can become policy. Two CEPR fellows at the conference who have had plenty of experience crossing that boundary are Reinhild Voigelus at the Catholic University Leuven, who's also a member of the European Research Council, and Dietmar Harhoff, who's Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship Research at the Max Planck Institute.
I think there were actually different dimensions in which research can actually help in that. First of all is trying to diagnose better what the problems are that policy should actually be identifying. And we had a lot of great presentations today and yesterday here trying to identify better that diagnosis. And that's the first important contribution for policy making, to have the better diagnosis ready. But then also secondly, and that's perhaps where we should have a bit more research on that, is what kind of instruments would then be the best ones to tackle those problems?
Reinhild is absolutely right. We also need to make innovation policy, in a sense, more experimental.
Yes.
That in many areas, especially when we think about regulation of the blockchain, regulation of AI, artificial intelligence, and so forth, gone are the times where we could think for a year or something like that, draft a letter that would outline the perfect regulation, give that to the policymakers, and let them implement it perfectly. So what we need now is more experimentation, and both the policymakers and the researchers need to be involved in that in order to turn that really into causal evidence, into turning it into something that they can build on.
Experimenting is not just an excuse that you can do whatever you want. It really has to be done in a scientific, correct fashion. It's only then that we actually learn from these experiments here. So I fully agree we need to experiment more, but we need to learn from the experiment.
Oh, absolutely. It shouldn't be experiments for their own sake.
No, exactly.
It has to have a fair chance of generating a lesson that can be applied, either by saying, look, we now know for sure this is not the right way, it fails, okay, so let's put it aside, or this is promising, so let's work on it, let's refine it further.
These ideas sound great in theory, but are they practical?
It requires changes on both sides. So it cannot be, or it should not be the case that we as economists simply write a chapter into our papers that says policy implications, and then we go through everything that is thinkable, but may have absolutely little to do with the real world. At the same time, on the other side, it should not be the case that the academics are knocking at the door of ministries, and essentially they are greeted by a crowd that says, don't disturb my circle here, because my career planning is just in a decisive stage. So sometimes when I cannot sleep, I dream of institutions like policy accelerators, policy laboratories, something like that. Stuff that we have had very much in the agile software development world. There's a manifesto for agile software development. So maybe we need a manifesto for agile innovation policy making, right? Mm-hmm. And that should really state that experiments are fine. It should state that plans do not have to come in a highly sophisticated, finalized version that can be implemented in a snap second or something like that, because that's completely unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And it puts a lot of pressure on the decision makers to fulfill unrealistic expectations.
Yeah. I'm a bit less optimistic, but I fully agree with your analysis here. What I see also, if you really start implementing policy, then suddenly it becomes like all these lobbying activities are taking place, and they see this as what's in it for me. And it's no longer this positive sum game you're looking for, it's a zero-sum game. And a lot of practical details and implementation then gets determined by this lobbying process here, and then you lose a lot of efficiency. So even if you would have these greatest ideas of how to design it, when you start practically implementing that process, I think we also need to understand better.
Those are stakeholders, and as much as it is a real nuisance to have in the last second of, say, implementing a R&D tax credit or something like that. Right now we have that in Germany. Some of the big industrial associations come in and say, we don't want this instrument just for the small companies. Have mercy on us. The big ones need to profit from it too, right? And they look at you with big round eyes. I think we need to sort of bring those stakeholders into the process relatively early, to understand what driving forces are. They sometimes have good suggestions. They are definitely closer to reality than we are. They know what an innovation process is and so forth.
So
we need to understand that we're not at odds here. So that would also be part of these laboratories or accelerators to sort of pick up what they're saying, but also bring in a buffer and communicate to them, look, this is not self-service. This will be evaluated, and it's for the better of the citizens and not just for the better of the large enterprises.
Jonathan Haskell of Imperial College is also a CPR fellow. He's an expert on how innovation creates economic growth. What challenges does he think any future innovation research and policy has to recognise?
The locus of innovation is changing very profoundly. So in the 1920s and 1930s, we had the start of the R&D lab, which was essentially powering manufacturing, pharmaceuticals, planes, cars, you know, the great sort of transport and health revolutions around that kind of area, very focused on manufacturing, very focused on kind of formalizing the process of R&D. But the locus of innovation, I think, has changed much more recently. And where is it? Well, it's in the service sectors. So what do I mean by that? I mean that we now have innovation in the software sector, for example. So the Googles and the Apples and the people like that, who aren't really doing much manufacturing. Google not doing any manufacturing whatsoever. Uber aren't doing any manufacturing whatsoever. But they're doing tons and tons of, if I might call it, broadly based research and development. So they're writing software, they're building databases, they're building, you know, marketing algorithms to understand how to sell stuff to you and me. So that's kind of one very important area where that locus has changed. And the other area where it's changed is around things like artistic originals, things like marketing training, things like firms building the types of competencies that they need to run international supply chains and to, you know, market products to you and me. So that change in the structure of the economy from manufacturing to services is one part of it. and that change in the kind of locus of innovation around the new kind of forms of innovative expenditure, I think, is another ingredient.
Yeah, Jonathan, companies like Google and Uber that you mentioned, they seem to be doing pretty well without government support. So can we be sure there is a need for public policy around innovation?
Think back to a traditional R&D world. We've got lots of work in economics which says that the point about R&D is that there are spillovers from R&D. If I have some kind of invention, you might be able to copy it, even if it might be patent protected. So there's a rationale for supporting R&D. But I think one of the interesting insights, if you start thinking about how the locus of innovation has changed, it takes you into some various different directions. So if we think about the world of software applied to, let us say, movies in the creative sector, then the locus of innovation and the types of policies that you need aren't so much around R&D tax credits and university departments. They're around clusters. And once you start thinking about clusters, you start thinking about Silicon Valley, or you start thinking about the software cluster, you know, around Tel Aviv and Israel and places like that. And that immediately gets you into cities and regional policy. And that gets you into immigration policy as the types of things which are going to affect the formation of those clusters and the passing of information from one to the other. That's a slightly different feel to R&D tax credits and all of that.
Okay, now sometimes we invite our interviewees to be omnipotent policymaker for a day. So to encourage more innovation in Europe, what would be your wish?
Limiting an economist to only one policy is, of course, a deadly question to ask, because we like to have, on the one hand, on the other hand, and since we live in an era of Brexit, Tim, I suppose I'd have to say that what I really want is a reduction in uncertainty. If I think about in my current job, I have the great privilege of being on the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee. As we have said over and over again, there's a lot of uncertainty hanging over the British economy at the moment. We think that that uncertainty is bad for investment. Firms don't quite know what to do. They don't quite know what the outlook is going to be. The option value of waiting is therefore pretty high for them, so they're probably holding back their investment projects. You see that in the investment data. Both the traditional types of tangible investment, such as cars and trains and trucks and buildings, and the more non-traditional types of intangible investment, R&D and so forth, all the subject of this conference. You see firms holding back with those types of investment behavior quite severely. And what we need was a resolution of this uncertainty and hopefully the pent-up investment in, as I say, that range of assets would come back again.
As a member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, imagining himself as an omnipotent policymaker maybe isn't such a bigger stretch for Jonathan as it is for the rest of us. But removing economic uncertainty is probably beyond the remit even of Frame. So when there are so many other macroeconomic challenges to solve in Europe, does Roman Arjona at DG Innovation think that putting funding and time into Frame has been worthwhile?
Absolutely. When we look at the kind of work that Frame has done, we see that they have managed to expand quite a bit, you know, I mean, our knowledge on everything that is linked to technology diffusion aspects. We see that we have now a much more clear idea in current models as to how technology is diffusing and how this is changing the dynamics and the functioning of this type of models. And I think this will be extremely important in order to be able to contextualize policy results, to be able to better inform policymaking, to be able to take us to this better allocation of resources on the basis of some empirical evidence, which is solid. So I think on the technology diffusion angle, Frame has given us a lot of clues, also in issues relating to human capital and skills, which were issues which were normally tackled in a rather exogenous, frivolous to a certain extent approach in the past. And I think that Frame has also, you know, I mean, put a spotlight, you know, I mean, on some of these issues and made a way forward. So yes, we're very happy with the kind of stuff that we're getting out of Frame, and we think it's going to be very useful as well for the researchers that are operating in this area.
You can decide for yourself whether you agree with Roman and the other attendees at the conference by going to the Frame website. It's at www.h2020frame.eu. And don't forget our Vox Talk with Diego Comín from September 2018. That was called The Impact of Innovation. And in it, he talks about some of the research work that he and his colleagues have done. You can find that and all the other episodes of Vox Talks on your podcast platform or at www.voxeu.org/vox-talks.